From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Robert Krulwich is one of NPR's most popular reporters, and the secret of his success may be his ability to identify with the average listener.
The thing is, I have always been, I'm not stupid or anything, but I've always been a bit of a slow processor. I will go into a room and everyone will say, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to climb over there, go to the room, and I just don't know what happened.
Today, Robert Krulwich reveals the secrets of the science desk as we look at the different ways people can learn science. We'll hear what happens when Isaac Newton goes hip-hop and find out why Albert Einstein's family considered him the dumb one. And we'll meet Paula Apsel. For years, she's been steering the good ship Nova through the tumultuous seas of changing TV technology.
No matter what your subject matter is, when you go from a 4-channel universe to a 400-channel universe, there are going to be a lot of changes.
We're listening to the opening number from FMA Live, a multimedia theatrical presentation now playing in schools across the country. When FMA Live came to Madison, Wisconsin, cast member Candy Hall and tour manager Ron Hemke stopped by our studios to talk about new ways to teach science in elementary school.
There is a huge demand to try to find kids to pursue careers in math and science, and they really wanted to find a way to connect with the kids in a way that would get them interested in science and math. NASA believes that somewhere in a middle school classroom in America right now are the first people who are going to step foot on Mars. And so it's a huge undertaking.
Why Isaac Newton, Candy? What is it special about Isaac Newton that you think will connect to the kids?
Well, I think that the demonstrations and the VH1, there's this huge video presentation that's VH1 explaining Isaac Newton's laws and him setting him back in the day when he was in school. That really captures the kids' attention. And with him just discovering or setting in motion the universal law of gravity and the three laws of motion, they're all basically the foundation for what we know today in the science and the space travel.
Tell me about the three laws. I admit my last high school science class was a long, long time ago.
The first law is objects in motion or at rest will stay that way unless acted on by an outside force. And in our case, the outside force is a huge Velcro wall.
This condition you may have heard of, it's something everybody calls inertia.
Kind of like a car moving up the hill, it keeps you moving forward and standing still.
So if you don't know, then pay attention, talking about Newton's law number one.
If you want to climb, we'll have to serve you. Knowledge and effects, it's called inertia.
The word for this condition won't hurt you. Even keeps you standing still, it's called inertia.
Okay, so the first law is inertia,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay, and law number two?
Law number two is force equals mass times acceleration, hence the name FMA Live.
To get the force, just multiply mass and acceleration.
How do you demonstrate that?
Well, we have probably the biggest part of the show, actually, and the most popular, you probably agree, the extreme wrestling. We have their teachers or administrators wrestle each other and using their masks in a pretty comical way.
Yeah, they're dressed in big, like, fat suits, and they have their wrestling shorts on, and they go back and forth, and it's so much fun. The kids love it, and they cheer for their favorite teacher. But it shows just, you know, as the more acceleration, mm-hmm. the greater force it creates by knocking them over, and then they actually get to go at it. So it's a lot of fun.
So force equals mass times acceleration.
Yes.
Which brings us to law number three.
Law number three, which is for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction.
Okay, that's the one everybody's heard.
Yes. Everybody knows that.
Everybody knows that.
Everybody knows inertia, and for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction.
So we all know it. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. But what do you do to make it come alive?
We actually have a hover chair in the show.
A hover chair.
A hover chair that does hover slightly above the stage using CO2 and nitrogen, compressed gases. We kind of bring all three laws together in that one. And Candy's up there for that one. I think that's one of her favorite because It gets kind of messy, and I think she enjoys
it. That was a lot of fun. It was specifically for Law Number 3, we also have the dragsters. We have these two cars, and two of the young people from the audience, again, two of the students, actually get to race each other in the cars. But the cars have compressed CO2
CO2
that shoots out the back of the car, so the gas is going this way. But the cars, that creates an action that shoots the cars the opposite way across the stage. So they actually race, and that explains the laws very well. The kids really get that one.
Reaction. A rocket ship can't get into space without the force to push the other way. And every planet's gotta have its own orbit. Act like a sponge till it's time to absorb it. Action.
Give it its own attraction with an equal and opposite reaction.
Reaction.
Like the positive reacts to the negative. These are the facts about Law 3 affirmative.
Action. Reaction.
Music from FMA Live. We talked with cast member Candy Hall and tour manager Ron Himke. FMA Live is great if you're still in school, but a lot of us rely on public television to keep up with what's going on in science. Every week, NOVA brings viewers the news of the universe. Like this, from an upcoming program.
Patrolling space like a sentry, the satellite telescope SWIFT is on constant lookout for cosmic disasters. And when it finds one, down on Earth, word spreads quickly. Every few days, the satellite spots a violent eruption in deep space, sending dozens of stargazers scrambling. Whether they're seasoned pros or high school amateurs, their goal is the same.
Go to camera focus mode, then we're going to need to move the dome. Casey?
To catch a glimpse of a star in its final death throes. Going supernova. And leaving in its wake the strangest phenomenon in the cosmos. A black hole.
Nothing survives encounters with black holes. The black hole wins. It wins every time.
When something falls into a black hole, it's essentially gone from our universe.
That's a big galaxy, and right down at the center, we think there's probably a black hole that's got a mass now that approaches a billion suns.
Today, scientists are finding black holes are bigger, stronger, and more destructive than they ever imagined.
Did the universe really have to be made with these things in it?
We'd like to think they're far, far away, but what if, in our own cosmic backyard, there lurks the monster of the Milky Way? Right now on NOVA.
Can't wait to watch the whole show. Paula Absel is the woman who's been at the helm of NOVA for years. She does for NOVA what Steve Paulson does for us. So they had a lot to talk about.
What did you do to change NOVA in response to competition?
Well, I believe anyway in a long-running series that whether or not you have competition, you have to change or die. You know, you can't make a television program and keep it the same for years and years and years. It just won't look very contemporary. So I guess what I did was I decided to give it a more modern look. And I kind of have like a motto. Keep the substance the same, but change the style. And I think the style is where we have a lot of flexibility. I sped it up a little. You know, NOVA was getting very slow and ponderous. I tried to make it look more modern. I tried to use more modern visual techniques. And this was at a time when computer animation was really beginning. And so I tried to really milk those techniques. It's the same substance, the same level of technical detail, the same kind of quality in terms of content, but it has a different style and is just a lot more entertaining.
Well, it's interesting because in public radio, the word educational has a really bad rap in some circles. I mean, it's considered boring, old-fashioned, you know, it's what you're supposed to learn in school, the opposite of entertaining. And I'm wondering how important it is for your TV show, NOVA, to be educational.
Well, I think that the educational mission is what keeps PBS unique. And one of the things that we offer is that we really do have an educational mission. So I think it's time to kind of stop being ashamed of that and start really reveling in it. And I don't think educational needs to be boring. I think that if you have a contemporary, quick-paced, highly visual style, if you have really great characters, people can still learn a lot, and they can also really enjoy the program while they're doing it. One of the examples that I will cite is The Elegant Universe, which is our miniseries on string theory with the physicist Brian Greene from Columbia University. Now, this is heavy-duty physics. This is not for the faint of heart. It's also a subject that has absolutely nothing, not one thing to do with daily life. It's
right.
Not going to improve your life.
It's totally
at
on the
all.
Theoretical level.
Absolutely. It's very, very abstract. And yet, I would say that of all the programs we've done, in terms of the kind of response from viewers, the sheer delight that viewers expressed to us, the fact that I saw Brian's book, The Elegant Universe, popping up all over airports right after we had it on the air, and when the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, they did a very intense series of focus groups, not for The Elegant Universe or for NOVA, but for overall PBS broadcasting. And I went to see the focus group in Boston, and I've read the text of many of the other focus groups. And it was amazing how many people, and these were not people of the educational or financial elite. These were really kind of just folks, actually the kind of people who go, you know, want the $75 that you get for an evening to participate in a focus group. And when they say, what have you watched on PBS lately that really struck you, that had some impact? I couldn't believe how many of them said, well, there was this thing on string theory, you know, I think it was called The Elegant Universe. And they went on to talk about it in a way that really showed that the kind of message from that had really penetrated. So you get surprised by the audience.
So how do you do a series or a documentary on string theory? How do you make that come to life?
Well, you know, I'm very big on storytelling. So storytelling is kind of my shtick. And, you know, I don't like shows that are 100 facts about something. I think those are boring. I don't like shows that are a list. I don't like shows that go from this lab to that lab to the other lab and never get anywhere.
Are you very careful about the topics you select for NOVA?
Choosing the topics are the most important decisions I make. And if I make a wrong decision, which I do occasionally, and a story doesn't really pan out, most of the time you have to go through with it anyway, and so you have to live with that bad decision for a long time. So we make 18 new programs a year, plus our 5 programs of our spin-off, Nova Science Now, with the host Neil deGrasse Tyson. For Nova Science Now, you're choosing shorter stories. There are 4 of them in every program. Those decisions are a little bit easier to make. But for Nova, you know, only 18 new programs a year, not all of which we can make. So some of them are programs that we have to acquire from others or co-produce in a consortium of broadcasters. So you're limited in your choice there. So the choices you have to make are very, very, very precious.
So what are some of the most popular topics? What do you know will appeal to your audience?
Well, I don't make choices based on what will appeal to the audience. That's just one criteria. I have a bunch of criteria. Mm-hmm. One is, yeah, of course, I you know, we'd like people to watch our programs, but on the other hand, we will make programs from time to time that we know that will get very small viewership. But we have to do it. That's really important.
You're very mission-driven, is what you're saying.
We're very mission-driven. But on the other hand, I do factor in whether a program will be popular. And sometimes I do a program because I'm excited about its potential popularity. But it has to satisfy other criteria, too. Is it something in science that's really important? Is there something new about it? Is there potential for story there? Is the show going to end up in a different place from where it started? Does this have a potential to be visualized, or is this, a radio show? How are the scientists in it? Can they speak English? Are they decent performers? Are we going to be able to, you know, make them talk in a way that the audience will find compelling? So
do you end up interviewing some scientists who you just dump because, I mean, after you've already taped the interviews, just they didn't work, they weren't compelling enough?
We don't use them, or we try to fix them up, or we go back and do another interview. You know, you can work hard with scientists. I always say there are few A's and there are a few C's. Most scientists are kind of B speakers. And most of those B speakers, you can really work with them. And you can, if you're very carefully prepared, if you do a very intensive pre-interview, so you really have a very good understanding of what you want that particular scientist to say, you can help those scientists to express themselves better and in a way that will be germane to the story that you're telling.
Give me an example of that, how you can coach a scientist to do a good interview.
Now, sometimes people freeze when the camera's on or they don't express it very well. So if it's your first interview with them, you may never, if you do it right on camera, you may never get them, you may never find out what they really have to say. But I would say sometimes, you know, that's really interesting. But I do want to remind you that when I came here a couple of weeks ago, you told me this and this and this. And I think our viewers would really be interested in it. So what question could I ask you that would prompt you and help you to say that? I'm not trying to put words in their mouth. These are their words.
And it started raining and then got cold. We got sleet. It snowed. We had brought in a big photovoltaic array. It was about 30 kilowatts. And here is President Carter standing in front of this 30-kilowatt array, reaching out with his hand and thought he would help a little bit by wiping the surface of these solar cells. And I remember I was able to grab the president's arm at that time because I was really afraid, thinking that this would be the first time that an American president had been electrocuted by a solar technology. You know, I didn't think this would do our technology very good.
Or maybe I'm asking them to give too much information. I need to break my questions up into more bite-sized pieces. And so I think that there are a lot of techniques that you can use to put people at their ease. But I don't think there's anything wrong with prompting them to give you answers that they had already given you before. Mm-hmm. They may not remember it, or they may be embarrassed because they knew they said it to you before. Nobody likes to repeat themselves.
What about the new technologies that are out there now? I mean, obviously the internet, but all the digital technologies. Does that affect you? Does that pose a threat to you? I mean, do you feel like once again you have to sort of rethink NOVA to be able to deal with all the new media that are out there?
I don't really think so. I think the new technologies are a real benefit. But of course, the technology that I think is most key to us is the internet, because we're able to do on NOVA online. There's so much material from each program, and there are so many interesting aspects to it, and we're able to really add value to what we do both on NOVA and NOVA Science Now, and I think involve a lot of young people who might not necessarily watch a television program, but they will watch something streamed on the web. And so I think it enables us to reach out to that kind of elusive 18 to 34 age group. And that's important because these are the kids that watch Sesame Street, and we want them back.
Paula Apsel is senior executive producer for NOVA. She talked with Steve Paulson. If I say she's smart, but she's no Einstein, you know exactly what I mean.
Smart people are a dime a dozen. It takes something else to make you really brilliant.
That's Walter Isaacson, Einstein's biographer. We'll meet him next. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. There's one name, Albert Einstein, which has become synonymous with genius. In the century since he made his greatest discoveries, no one has brought physics further, nor does it seem likely that anyone will. Walter Isaacson has written a magnificent biography of the man who revolutionized our understanding of space and time. Steve Paulson asked him how Einstein's personality influenced his intelligence.
First of all, he was rebellious. He thought unconventionally all the time. Secondly, he was slow in learning how to talk. I mean, the great news for us parents is that he was no Einstein when he was a kid. His parents called him the dopey one. I think because he thought in pictures, he was very imaginative. Even mathematics came to him in sort of visual thought experiments, he called them. It's what you and I call daydreaming when we're not Einstein. And so as a kid, he would imagine what it would be like to try to ride alongside a light wave, and could you catch up with it? And so when he's a patent examiner, there are a lot people in the European physics community who are more knowledgeable and probably as smart in mathematics, people like Max Planck. But Max Planck comes up with a constant that he puts in his formulas, has no idea what it is, but Einstein, as a patent clerk, says it's because light's a particle. Light is both wave and particle. It was that imaginative type of leap that I think made Einstein a genius.
Well, you make the point that even as a child, it wasn't so much the mysterious things that he puzzled over. It was actually the commonplace things.
You know, he said, I was so slow in learning that I was still puzzling over the passage of time where everybody else had kind of gotten over it. When he's 5 years old, his dad gives him a compass. And he sits up in bed night after night with chills in his spine, he says, as he watches that needle twitch and point northward, and thinking there must be unseen forces in the universe that are making this happen, and how does a force field work? I don't know about you, but I remember getting a compass around that age, and like, you know, for 5 minutes I thought, wow, cool.
Right.
And then I was on to something else. So here's a guy marveling, as you said, about the merely ordinary stuff that we just sort of shrug our shoulders at after a while.
Hmm. Now, you mentioned his rebellious streak, and it seems that this played out in a couple of ways. One thing is he didn't have much patience for rote learning, especially memorization, and he also didn't kowtow to authority figures. In fact, some of his teachers didn't really like him very much because he wouldn't play the usual game.
He questioned every premise. He didn't kowtow to authority. He hated rote learning. One headmaster basically sends him packing. Einstein leaves and is a dropout from the high school in Munich. Another amuses us by saying this Einstein won't amount to much. He finally gets in to the Zurich Polytechnic on his second try at getting admitted. But once again, he's able to tick off all three of his professors there. So by the time he graduates, he can't even get a recommendation from his professors. In one lab class, he had thrown away the instructions, tried an experiment his own way, blew up the equipment, and they put him on academic probation.
Did his teachers recognize that he was brilliant as he was growing up, or for that matter, did his parents?
Well, his teachers certainly did, and I think every Jewish parent thinks their kid is brilliant. So I assume that Pauline and Hermann Einstein knew he was a genius, even though they were somewhat frustrated by his bad behavior in school. But the teachers definitely did not know that. You know, one of the myths about him is that he flunked math. At least he passes math very well, but partly because he visualizes things. He's able to visualize the Pythagorean theorem just by comparing in his head triangles of different sizes. You know, when he's at the Zurich Polytech even, not only do they not recognize him as a genius, they won't give him a teaching fellowship or even a chance to be a doctoral fellow.
Hmm. Do you have favorite stories that illustrate his rebellious nature as he was coming of age?
Well, yes. I mean, as I say, he blows up the lab equipment, he runs away from school and stuff like that. But his rebellious nature in his thinking, when he is sitting there as a patent clerk, in 1905, because he can't get a job as anything else. He can't get a job at a university or high school. And he's examining patent applications, and he questions every single premise. At one point, they're trying to synchronize clocks because it's in Switzerland, and they're kind of obsessive about getting clocks synchronized in Switzerland, and they had just gone on standard time zones. And all of the devices that used to synchronize the clocks send a signal between the two clocks, and a signal that travels at the speed of light, meaning a light signal or a radio signal or an electric signal. And he is sort of rebellious. He even questions the premise of how do we know two things are simultaneous? Now, you and I, just as we probably didn't marvel over a compass for days on end, don't sit there wondering how you define two events as simultaneous. You say it happens at the same time. But Einstein sort of rebels against those premises and says we have to define how the signal would get to us to tell us something happened at the same time. And that's when he comes up with the notion that if you're moving, that signal will get to you in a different way than if you're standing, say, on the train platform. So what's simultaneous is relative to your state of motion. And from that, he comes up with the theory of relativity.
Hmm. Was that a brand new idea? I mean, did he just pluck this out of nothing? Or was he building on certain intellectual ideas that had come before?
The two great ideas that create 20th century physics, quantum theory and relativity theory, both pop into Einstein's head when he's a patent clerk in the same three-month period in spring of 1905. And both of them are what you could call quantum leaps. By a quantum leap, it doesn't just mean a big leap. It means a disconnected leap. It means a leap that isn't just built incrementally on something that was there right before it. The notion that light is both a wave and a particle is just a new out-of-the-box way of thinking. Secondly, relativity theory. You had really smart professors dealing with this subject. Poincaré, Lorentz, Planck are all looking at moving bodies and why the speed of light is constant. But it takes this patent examiner to make the leap that time slows down for you as you approach the speed of light. And that's why he could never catch up with a light wave in his thought experiment when he was 16 years old. Even after he makes this leap, people like Poincaré and Planck, Lorentz, they're all reading that paper, and they still don't quite get it. So yes, this was a disconnected leap. This was something totally imaginative and rebellious.
Now, you make the point that it was actually an extraordinarily good stroke of luck for him that he was a patent clerk during those early years. After he'd finished school, he couldn't get a job as a physics professor. He went off and, you know, had this rather menial job. But it gave him time to think. And if he had actually gotten a job, say, as a junior professor of physics somewhere, he might not have been able to do that.
Well, it would not have been a pretty sight thinking of Einstein as an acolyte in the academy trying to please a senior professor. He wouldn't have been questioning the conventional wisdom as easily. As a patent clerk, he is doing what he does best, which is do thought experiments where you try to picture the underlying physical reality behind certain concepts, like a device that would synchronize clocks, for example. And he also has a boss that says, question every premise. And he's looking out at that burned clock tower, the famous old 11th century clock tower with the train speeding by. And he's got friends and they're discussing philosophy. It's perfect for a guy who doesn't want to just build on some older professor's theories, but wants to revolutionize physics.
So is this a case of the solitary genius sitting at his desk working out these thought experiments?
No, although Einstein liked to think of himself as a solitary genius, and he thought of himself as a loner, and in some ways he kind of was. But the new papers that have come out, you find out this guy wasn't a loner. He's sitting there walking with his two or three best friends, Michele Besso, Conrad Habeck. They're doing thought experiments together. They form something called the Olympia Academy, which is where they go out and eat sausages and drink strong coffee and pretend to be, you know, scholars and stuff. He loved having sounding boards, but he did not have collaborators. There was no one person who sort of worked hand in glove with him. But he loved hanging around other people and using them as sounding boards.
Well, you've talked about the conceptual leaps that he was able to make, especially in those early years. I mean, you described them as quantum leaps. Do you have any sense of how he was able to do this? I mean, what did he bring to the table? I mean, other than those personal qualities of rebelliousness and, you know, thinking about things a new way. I mean, why was he able to do this in a way that no other scientist at the time could?
I think he threw out all conventional thinking. I mean, Newton says in Book 2 of the Principia that time marches along second by second, irrespective of anybody observing it. And Einstein says, how do we know that? Now, that's a pretty hard thing to question. Like, how do we know that? You just always assume time marches along second by second, irrespective of us looking at it. And I think it was the ability to think out of the box and question premises that separates him and makes him in just a different orbit, a real, you know, up in the pantheon with Galileo and Newton from every other scientist.
Which I guess makes you wonder whether there still are people with that genius who are doing that today. I mean, questioning those very basic assumptions.
I think it would be hard, but who knows, to just totally throw out the underlying premises of science. But at some point, maybe in our lifetime, maybe in our grandchildren's, somebody will figure out what Einstein on his deathbed died still trying to do, which is what he called the unified theory, that would tie together relativity and electromagnetism and quantum mechanics and sort of have one big field theory that would explain all the forces of the universe. I think that's going to take a major conceptual leap. People are doing it with string theory now, but they're sort of dealing with the math at the moment. I think we need a conceptual breakthrough to win that battle.
Now, one of the great mysteries about Einstein's life is that he produced these incredible papers, four papers in 1905 that totally overturned the premises of physics, but he couldn't get an actual job as a physics professor for a number of years after that. Did physicists just not understand the importance of those first papers?
Yes. It took a while. Max Planck was one of the early ones to figure out that this patent clerk down in Bern, or he actually thought he was at the university in Bern, and when he sent an assistant to go find Einstein, was stunned to learn that the guy was actually at the patent office. So yes, it takes a while for the physics establishment to come to grips with it.
Now, of course, eventually he was recognized for his achievements, became one of the most famous people in the world, the symbol of scientific genius. But none of his scientific work really, after the age of 40, came close to what he had done earlier. How do you explain that?
Well, let's look at ourselves. I mean, we all turned 50 or 45 or whatever, and we've been rebellious maybe, and very imaginative and very creative. And Einstein was. He threw out everything in classical physics in 1905, and again in 1915 when he throws out Newton's theory of gravity. But then, after he wins his Nobel Prize, the younger Turks in physics are taking his quantum theory and turning it into a mechanics that involves uncertainties, like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, and probabilities and chance, and there's no underlying cause and effect, strict causality in nature. And Einstein just doesn't believe this. He says, I cannot believe that God plays dice with the universe. And he spins down into a defensive crouch, trying to protect the strict causality and realism of classical physics. And they say, but when you were younger, you were throwing out anything that couldn't be observed. You were willing to question every premise. And finally he says, well, perhaps to punish me for my contempt for authority, fate turned me into an authority myself. And we may find this mysterious. In some ways it's the most mysterious thing about Einstein, but maybe it's the least mysterious thing, because most of us were never quite as imaginative and rebellious in the second half of our lives as we are in the first. And maybe that's one of the things I like exploring in this book, is why.
Walter Isaacson is the author of Einstein, His Life and Universe. He spoke with Steve Paulson. What do you think? How much longer will we live in Einstein's universe? Will we see a proof for string theory in this generation? Send us your thoughts at our website. It's ttbook.org. So, what if you're no Einstein, but you love science and want to report on it? How do you get people interested in important stories that aren't exactly a barrel of laughs? Robert Krulwich knows.
What would it be like if you wanted to be happy about global warming? So I tried to imagine a situation where I would find the whole thing a kind of delightful adventure to learn about perhaps my demise.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Not many reporters would dream up a little opera to explain interest rates, but Robert Krulwich did. ABC Television now shares Robert's peculiar genius with NPR and Radiolab. He once tried to talk Ted Koppel into letting him become the reporter in charge of stories about little tiny things with catastrophic consequences, like AIDS and computer viruses. Koppel wouldn't buy it. But TV Guide has called Krulwich the most inventive network reporter on television. And for years, he's been a legend in public radio. And Strange Champs found him at NPR's New York Bureau. He splits his time there between NPR's science desk and the program Radiolab. and wondered, why science?
I think that most people are very interested in this stuff, but believe that it's a little too hard for them. And the reporting doesn't help them out, so it'll start in the middle. Like if you were from Mars, I said, hey, let's go cover a hockey game, okay? They'll go outside with a big glove, go to the outside, let me beat the bat. You'd see all these people. You wouldn't even know exactly yet where the puck was. If, however, I brought you in 10 minutes before and I said, so here's the deal. There's going to be this team in the blue is going to be trying to do something to that team in the red. The red team is defending. The blue team is attacking. And then they're going to switch. I don't know. And sometimes they're going to have more people on the ice and sometimes fewer people on the ice. And here's what you see how mean he is? They're allowed to do that. If you teach people the game, then they can follow it. So the thing is, I have always been, I'm not stupid or anything, but I've always been a bit of a slow processor in everything. So I've noticed my whole life that I will go into a room and everyone will say, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to climb over there, go to there, we're going to kill somebody, and I just don't know what happened. And I pretend to know, so I know what that feels like. And then I try to work it out as best I can. And I realized kind of early on in my reporting career that what might pass as a learning disability could be considered an asset if you realize that most people don't know what the heck's going on anywhere, and particularly in science. So I just taught myself these things from the very beginning. So a lot of the stories start at the start.
Well, for instance, there's a piece that I can't count how many people came up to me and asked if I'd heard this. It was the piece you did on NPR recently on carbon atoms. And it was right for a series NPR was doing on climate change, but you weren't talking about climate. You were talking about how carbon atoms behave.
I started at the beginning. Well, I wondered, I thought, well, I'd seen the Al Gore show, and I thought, well, that's kind of, you know, very, very well done and sort of sober and somewhat sad and somewhat ponderous. And you have to be in a, I think I'll think about the world mood in order to watch that one. So I thought to myself, well, what would it be like if you wanted to be happy about global warming? It's not the happiest subject. So I tried to imagine a situation where I would find the whole thing a kind of delightful adventure to learn about perhaps my demise. And it came down to the most interesting story to me when I began reading into it was the behavior of the carbon atom, which is a very old atom in the history of the universe. I mean, there were originally, you know, very stupid kind of little atoms, really little, helium and hydrogen, and there was nothing else. And then gradually stars were born and they began spitting out stuff. And one of the early things they spit out was carbon. And carbon has some extraordinarily wonderful properties which allow it to cling to other carbons and hydrogens and oxygens and nitrogens. And you can, it's a great building block atom. But it has an inordinate fondness for oxygen. Not just for one, it loves two. It's a polygamist kind of atom. And it just digs these two oxygen atoms. And its affinity for two oxygens, so we have a C and two O's, or famously CO2. That's your global warming problem. There's too much CO2 in the air. So I thought, why don't I just start all the way at the beginning and find out why C loves the O2s?
Choose your partners for a Portland fancy. Four hands around. The other way back.
And along the way, you illustrated carbon's behavior with square dance music.
These are all improvisations, partly. I mean, you find out who's around. I'm constantly explaining what I'm trying to do to other people who know nothing about any of this. And I watch their eyes very carefully to see whether they're enjoying it or understanding it or whether they're giving me that other thing called respect, which I don't want. I want that little thing that you can see in people's eyes called, hey, I still understand what he's talking about. So... Yeah, I think it's also important. I mean, in my case, and this is not for everybody, but a sense of humor is a form of intellectual seduction. If you have a complicated and difficult problem that you want to tackle, probably the wrong way to do it is to say, let's tackle now a very hard and difficult problem, because everybody stands up straight and goes, oh, no, secretly in there. The humor and that sort of stuff that I do is a literal attempt to signal this isn't going to be so hard and we will get there together and you will find it kind of enjoyable.
Do you think it's a big advantage to be working with sound in reporting on science?
The important thing here for me is to play. I think the act of playing, which is not normally associated with serious journalism, but in my way, in my serious way, I think about this fairly intently, I do in the sciences in particular, which is in our culture a somewhat obscure, somewhat holier than thou, very powerful group of people who talk in their own language and who talk down to the rest of us in general. It's very important to model a different kind of way of talking about science and talking to scientists. And on Radiolab, we make a very big point of cross-examining scientists, saying, come on, how do you know that? To people who've won a Nobel Prize, which you can almost see staring at you from their chest. But you're still allowed to say to a Nobel laureate, I have no idea what you're talking about. That's okay. And in a way, it teaches all of us to take any powerful person, be they a general or a congressman or a scientist, and question them. That's our, not only our right, but it's our obligation really in a democracy, is to exercise our minds.
I was wondering if that's one of the reasons. There's a little small thing you do on Radiolab that always strikes me. Almost always when you introduce a scientist, they introduce themselves. And almost always you're walking into the lab with them, or they come in the door and they introduce themselves. It makes them instantly real people rather than just talking heads on the radio.
Yeah, that's one of many things.
What other techniques do you use?
Well, we do challenge them. We make them laugh, or we notice all their funny little moods. We once were doing something about ants with a woman who had devoted her life to the study of ants. And what was particularly interesting to me is she hated them. These stupid. She at one point was looking at a little ant that had picked up a unit of rice, whatever you call that, a kernel of rice, and was holding it. And another ant came along on the other side and began pulling it in direction A. And the first ant was going in direction B, so the two ants were just tugging on either end of a rice grain. And she looked at these guys are going to do this for the next 12 hours unless I, you know, they're so stupid. They're so stupid. I said, well, why then do you hang around with them? She says, well, I don't know. And I thought, for all the people who are plumbers and cooks and accountants who said they looked out the window and said, what am I doing here? It's just nice to know that the scientists have, you know, the same thing. Sometimes they have it really bad because it's so boring sometimes doing, you know, very sophisticated science. You just have to do the same thing over and over and over again.
Do you have favorite stories that you've covered on Radiolab?
Usually my favorite story is the one that we're in the middle of, usually. So I am so proud of Radiolab. Jad Abumrad, my partner, is an unusual guy. He's a composer, really, not a trained journalist at all. His parents are both in the sciences, and he's very, very smart. But his training, really, is in beats and in music. And it's so much fun for me to sit next to somebody who can take a problem, a fairly dense intellectual problem, break it down, and then think about it the way a composer does.
You do play a lot with rhythm, both of you. There was one of those moments for me. I was listening to Radiolab. It was the sleep program. And there was a moment in there when I thought, I can't believe I'm listening to them talk about protein folding. Protein folding? And I understand this.
Excuse me? Proteins properly folded?
Mm-hmm. A phenomenon called the unfolded protein response.
What on earth does that mean? Well, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, you're asking, why do you need proteins to properly fold?
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm asking.
Well, you're made of proteins. Proteins are the essence of you. So if your proteins are misshapen, if they're not folded properly,
if you don't fold the proteins properly, they don't have the right three-dimensional structure. And as a result, they start accumulating inside the cell. And then these different unfolded proteins can aggregate together and form clumps. Clumps.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that Radiolab program on sleep that you guys did, because you use a lot of the techniques we've been talking about. But, you know, if you just looked at the rundown for that program, or if you just described to an editor and said, okay, we're going to do an hour on sleep, and we want to talk about rat dreams, and we want to talk about cat brains, and how dolphins sleep, people would snore.
And those weird people who, that guy who was the whoa, whoa, whoa. Remember that guy? There was this man who had nightmares, and he would hit his wife and sound like Santa Claus. Very interesting situation he was in.
But it doesn't necessarily sound like the most accessible program.
Well, I started and said, you know, how is it possible for a dolphin to go to sleep. I mean, they have to keep going up to the top of the water to breathe. They have those little holes on the top. And she said, I don't know. So we asked around, and the marine mammal community said, well, actually, these animals, not just the dolphins, but the whales and the others, they have bifurcated brains. So half of their head goes to sleep, and the other half is awake, and then they switch. In that particular show, I think I was mostly editing. He was leading. In other shows, I lead, and he edits. It depends.
Well, tell me about one in which you led, and what did you want to cover, and how did you decide which
pieces? I led in
the last
one on zoos. So I was very interested in what zoos are for these days. It's a puzzle to me. They seem to be taking in a lot of refugees, creatures who are having trouble living in the wild. But what kind of a job is it to take animals that are living in the wild while the wild places they live in are destroyed, which has to be a fundamentally bad thing, and then you get these kind of Noah's Ark refugees? But the point of Noah's Ark was that at the end of the day, he would release them back. What are we going to release our animals back to? And I wonder just what zoo people think about that. And I also noticed that zoos, like everything else in life, has to compete with TV screens. And I went to a couple of zoos where they had ants that were being magnified by cameras. And I noticed that the traffic at the TV, even at the zoo, traffic at the TV just stopped at the screen. And I thought, well, what is it now? What do zookeepers think about screens? And a reporter named Nell Boyce came up with a very interesting question. She said, why is it that at a zoo, I'm going to tell you a story, and it's going to be very familiar to you. Imagine a wild tigress sitting in her cage. She could eat you if she were hungry, and you're gone. Think of that tigress, and then imagine a mother coming into the zoo with a baby in a pram and taking the baby out of the pram and lifting it up and putting her baby's head right in front of the tigress, maybe 3/4 of an inch. There's just plexiglass between the baby and the tigress, and say, look, Darlene, the big kitty. Look at the big kitty. And the cold eyes of the tigress are staring at what could, must for the tigress, look like food. And the mother is putting her most precious thing, her own daughter, right in front of the wild animal. So something's wrong with this picture. The zoo goer doesn't understand this is a wild animal, or maybe it isn't a wild animal anymore. What is it?
I don't know. That just hit me because I do that with my kids all the time.
Well, so it was turned out to be a fascinating investigation. We were trying to figure out, well, like, what do they feed? Like, these are cats, so they're predators. They love hunting and catching live food. Have you ever seen that in a zoo? Never. You never see any animals hunting live animals. It would be gross, really. So we looked around, and we found out that in the east coast of the United States, they give these animals kibble, like cereal, from a box. That's what they eat. Well, that's such a downer. I mean, if you really want to take care of it, wouldn't it be fun for the cats to chase around a mouse or something? And we looked around. Does anyone do that? In Europe, they give hairy carcasses, dead hairy carcasses, to animals. And you can watch the animals fight over the carcasses and rip up the hair. In the United States, they think that's gross, except in southern Ohio, where in Toledo, they have a wild animal feeding for special guests only. And we went to that.
So we brought the boy down. Been pumped since my wife told me about it. So we made sure we got here early to check this out.
The carcasses were already out. The zookeeper comes out with her microphone and, like, sort of gives a little
part of our enrichment program
description of carcass feeding,
ensures that we meet
why they do it,
all of the animals' behavioral needs as well as their psychological needs. So what
and
that means is
nobody at this point is listening to the interpretive discussion of this because as she's doing this,
hey bud, I think I heard a door.
They let the tigers into the pen. Oh, look, here come the tigers.
Watch, Brian, look, the big one's coming down.
One of the tigers just, like, streaks across the pen and grabs the carcass and, like, you know, it starts, like, immediately playing with it. And I have never seen, in all my years of zoo going, I have never seen a tiger move that fast. Like, at one point, one of the tigers was, like, carrying one around by the ear. You could see, like, the little calf face, and it was dragging it around.
What were people doing? Were they cheering? Were they crying?
There was nobody there that seemed to be disturbed by it.
Really?
Although, here was a conversation that I heard many, many times. The children would say,
Mommy,
what is that? What is he eating? And the parent would say,
it's actually a baby cow.
It's a baby cow. And the kid would say, Why is he doing that?
Well, honey, the tigers have to eat.
Well, that's what he eats.
That's the kind of the food that they eat.
And the child would say, I don't eat cow.
But honey,
I don't eat cows.
Yeah, you do.
And the parent would say, what? Of course you eat cow.
At home. You eat hamburgers.
You eat hamburgers?
What do you think a hamburger is?
It's made out of cows.
Sure is.
And there would just be this shocked look on the kid. And I must have heard that conversation like 5 times.
Why the dead?
Because it's food, honey.
And then from China, we found out you go to the zoo, you can buy a goat and feed the live goat to the cats. And people do. And so we got on a bus in Beijing, went out to the zoo, and bought a chicken and fed it to a lion.
Wow, that's a new take on, the kids' zoo where you can give the little handful of grain to the goats.
Yeah. But this is all really fascinating to me. And also, there was a man I met who I just fell in love with, kind of. He's about my age. He is the closest thing I know living in the world to a 19th century African adventurer sort, with a pith helmet who goes by himself with a large posse of people deep into the darkest, darkest, darkest forest, the wildest, wildest places, and has adventures where no, white man has ever gone before, sort of thing. And this is a New York Jew from Queens. He was a gang leader when he was growing up. He fell in love with the Bronx Zoo, and he finds himself in a situation where he goes out into this very, very remote place, and immensely amazing things happen to him, and he's a great storyteller.
You almost never, never see a jaguar when you follow its tracks because it knows you're there. I mean, I was hoping against hope that maybe I'd see the jaguar, but actually I didn't think I would because they always knew I was coming and they'd always go away. And then it started getting dark, started getting late, and I didn't want to be in the jungle at night. And I didn't have a flashlight or anything. So that's when I turned around. And there was the jaguar about 15 feet away.
Behind you?
It was behind me. It'd been behind me probably quite a ways.
And it was pretty clear this cat had been creeping closer and closer.
To where by the time I turned around, it had shortened its distance between us really small. I mean, that was...
So it was in leaping distance?
I couldn't have gotten away from it.
Yeah.
And I knew that.
I wanted people to hear what it's really like to look into the eyes of a real cat in the real jungle when everything's wild and you're the prey. So that's kind of how the show got built.
Hmm.
But boy, it was fun. Oh,
that just,
I sat
so
on the
much...
porch of this guy, up in upstate New York, and I looked at him. He's got leukemia now, so he's not well. But I looked at him and I thought, I am so lucky to be able to spend any time with a guy like this, to be able to like touch him even. I sometimes get just crazy with happiness for being allowed to do this. It's just so precious to me.
Robert Krulwich co-hosts Radiolab and reports for NPR's Science Desk, and Strange Champs talked with him. You can find links on our website to the Radiolab programs we excerpted here. Come visit us at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 819B, Learning Science. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Mary Lou Finnegan, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson.
PRI, Public Radio International.